Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 21st of January 2019, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, well, welcome back, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Mike. The belated Happy New Year. Yeah. Great to be back.
Right. So we're going to get straight on with Theresa, and we'll just do a couple of seconds on Brexit here, because obviously she is going to the House of Commons this afternoon to set out what she is, well, her plan B, as was demanded by House of Commons last week. She's saying that she's going to lay a neutral motion for debate and for votes. And of course, there's going to be what kind of vote is it going to be? The last vote last week was a meaningful vote. This can only be an ultra meaningful vote, because it's even more important than the last one. So that's going to be on the 29th of January. MPs are going to put down some amendments to this. Two groups of MPs are the ones that are being talked about in the mainstream media at the moment. One group includes Yvette Cooper, Nicky Morgan from the Tories, and also Liberal Democrat MP Norman Lamb. They want to extend negotiations with the EU beyond the 29th of March, so they want to push the leave date back. That's if MPs don't approve the withdrawal agreement by the 29th of January. The second amendment that's already known about is going to allow backbenchers to choose to debate and vote on Brexit issues on one day a week. And the reason that the mainstream media is getting excited about that is because there is a convention that the government controls parliamentary timetable, not backbench MPs, and this would be breaking with tradition. So there you go, Patrick. That's the latest on Brexit. It continues to be a complete mess, as we predicted.
And we look forward to the mess that will ensue next week.
Absolutely. It is the gift which keeps on giving, no question of that. Now, last week, I published this article on the UK column, Military Union, British Government Policy since 1948. This is basically about the establishment of the Western Union, an EU light, if you want to call it that. It included military union. This was in the immediate post-war years. And the article covers Ernest Bevin's efforts in this area as Foreign Secretary. Now, of course, Bevin was Foreign Secretary to Clement Attlee. Well, by coincidence, on Saturday, going underground, Afshin Ratanzi had Lord Attlee, the grandson of Clement Attlee, on for interview. And it was a very interesting interview. So let's have a look at a couple of things that were discussed. Well, first of all, he was asked about Richard Dearlove and the others that were saying that Theresa May's Brexit deal is dangerous for national security. Afshin Ratanzi said to him, "You weren't swayed by such eminent people." And he said, well, he wasn't in a position to be swayed. You know, the role of the House of Lords is to revise legislation, be an additional check on the executive, that's the government, and be a source of expertise. But here's really the crux of what he was getting into. We do not want to get sucked into a European army and not be in the decision-making process. That's something to be avoided. So at this point, Patrick, I think I'm going to invite David Ellis onto the program and say welcome to the program, David. What were your thoughts on the Attlee interview, just briefly before we go through some of the things he said?
Great to be on the news again, especially with you, Pat. It's timely, isn't it, that another media organisation have picked this up subsequent to your article there, Mike. So we're really into the meat of it with this, that for Lord Attlee there to sort of step away from the question of being swayed with what Dearlove and Guthrie are saying, and that we want to be a rule maker, not a rule taker. Well, of course, the reality is at the moment, as best as I understand, is that we're currently a rule taker. So it's the other way up. So I'm not quite sure what frame Lord Attlee's seeing this, or what his version of is going on, or what the reality is as far as he's saying, because it's not as I recognise it.
Well, indeed. And he went on following this statement. He went on to say that clearly post-Brexit, there will have to be a very close security and defence relationship with our EU partners. NATO is in some difficulties. We've got the Trump problem. And he talked about the Trump problem, which was really, he said, Trump is quite right asking snotty questions about defence expenditure of European nations, especially of Germany, which only spends 1% of GDP on defence, whereas we're spending 2% of GDP on defence. And he said, yes, of course, we cook the books a bit. But he said that probably the Germans do the same as well. So, Patrick, this is this comes back to, I mean, it's nearly 2 years ago, that certainly 18 months ago, that Trump came over to Brussels and gave the European Union a hard time about the amount of money that they're spending on defence, saying that it has to end this situation of the United States effectively subsidising the defence of Europe.
Mm-hmm. There's two ways to look at this. You can look at it through the NATO lens, the traditional mainstream NATO lens, or you can take a step back, and this would sort of beggar belief to a lot of people that maybe perhaps Donald Trump is, and I'm not saying he's acting on his own volition 100%, Mike, but perhaps Donald Trump is attempting to execute a shift in United States post-World War II grand strategy. And so in his own Trumpian way, he's come out and called out NATO for what it is. It's a protection racket on behalf of the international defense industry. So everyone's got to chip in and buy their products, and everybody's happy campers. But really below that, Mike, it's about post-World War II grand strategy. The United States effectively occupied and provided the defense for Europe during the Cold War period. And the quid pro quo was it would do that. It would take care of Germany's defense. It would take care of Europe's defense. And then it would give European countries unfettered low tariff access to the U.S. market in order to build up their economies. And it worked. And the Marshall Plan, etc. Mm-hmm. The same with Japan. Now that the Cold War's finished, we've been in this odd, awkward transition period from 1991. It's taken a lot of people a long time to catch up. Trump just happens to be on the crest of the wave right now, and he's the first person to sort of openly, as a public figure, elected official, challenge that status quo. But what he's really doing, Mike, is he's giving the entree to what a lot of people in the world, and certainly in the East, already know, is that the world has moved on from the post-World War II structure, and we're entering a new period. And, you know, so history will look back at this, possibly, and see Donald Trump as a pivoting point in terms of the overall U.S. grand strategy to an offshore situation, pulling the assets offshore and then empowering local partners, finding regional enforcers to take care of collective defense rather than the United States providing that globally.
Now, one of the things that Attlee went on to talk about was the issue of conventional forces, David. And he was saying that, you know, we're in a situation at the moment where Britain cannot deploy a division against what he described as a peer opponent. Now, he went on to explain where that phrase came from. It came from the 2015 Defence Review. But he was making the point that when we were deployed to Iraq, Britain, a division was considered to be 25,000 people plus all the support that 25,000 people requires on the battlefield. And he's saying that very few countries now can even produce a brigade of conventional forces. That's 3,000 to 5,000 people. That would be basically Britain, the United States and France at the moment. So he's saying that 1989 was the last time that a division could be deployed. And this is really part of the mechanism which has been delivered in order to produce the reason for a military union. But he was making a very good point, and so he was asked who is the peer opponent that he's talking about, and he said, well, it's a polite way of saying Russia. But here was the key point, David, because he went on to say that when you have such a reduced conventional capability as we have, the nuclear tripwire is set much lower. And this was really, I have to say, the only point that I sort of agreed with in his whole interview. So he's basically making the point that because we've cut conventional forces to the point where really we're not in a position to compete with a peer, and whoever that might be, in this case Russia, then the likelihood of some kind of something escalating to a nuclear level is that much greater. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
In general, I think that it's an odd, it was perhaps an odd appearance for Lord Attlee to come on RT there. And I've got to say, in the main, I think it was overall, I could see some clarity from the news presenter's perspective on what he was trying to talk about and ascertain. But I think where Lord Attlee was concerned, I mean, it just came over as a bit disjointed as far as the policy, because he was sort of not really articulating the policy fully and properly and clearly, because we've had this is a long ongoing problem, as we now know. It's decades old, this policy in its core of military unification for Europe and defence union. So whilst Attlee has completely avoided talking about that and using the terms of reference, to then go into the likes of peer opponents and saying it's politely Russia, you know, well, there's nothing polite going on in this area at the moment. It's all very impolite. So I didn't like that. But when he started to talk about the nuclear tripwire, I've heard this a lot in circles in Parliament and in the Lords. And this is something that's talked about quite a lot, that with a reduction, and this is from all circles that I've been aware of, with a reduction in conventional forces, that this seems to be what people are saying, you know, well, we're getting closer to actually using the nukes, and they're calling it a tripwire. So I've got to say, fundamentally, and this is something we aired quite a few years ago on one of the insights that we all did jointly, is that there are two Cold Wars. There's a perceived Cold War, where that was shut down by the BBC when the wall came down at the end of the German contract. And then there's the real Cold War. Well, the real Cold War hasn't stopped, because it was about nuclear weapons. It always was. And they still exist. So therefore, if we wanted to view this completely stoically, they still exist. So therefore, the Cold War still is there and it's very real. Now, where they're talking about the divisional strengths, this is something that General Sir Mike Jackson, ex-former Chief of Defence Staff, has mentioned many, many times about he was opposed to the beam counters taking a hatchet to it over previous defence reviews and reducing the divisional strengths any further than what they already were, bearing in mind we're talking about something that's really slid since the not review in 81 that you've now got, we're going to see on the timeline, hopefully. And he's articulated that beautifully, as General Sir Mike Jackson. But it fell on deaf ears, as all of the officer advice has happened over this period, where they've all spoke out. Because the engine room there in the Cabinet Office is set and tasked and designated to conduct defence union, military union, military unification. So, you know, what the Germans are calling it, defence union, it's set and tasked and designated. They just don't want to talk about it. Now, all the while, the MPs and the Lords are not talking about it. It carries on. And we have this manifestation where we get somebody like Lord Attlee come along, where it's a little bit disjointed in the interview, because it's, you know, it's not really coming over to exactly what the reality is. So there's our principal problem. You know, we've got to raise the debate level, and we have to start by everybody getting to grips with the use of the terminology.
Nuclear tripwires.
Well, this is a very interesting concept, and David rightly points this out. Go back to that slide about the tripwire here. This is the question, and I think probably I think this is what David was really asking, was who is going to set the tripwire? Is this the UK? What is a tripwire? Is tripwire is triggered. Is the UK? Is Lord Attlee inferring that the UK, with reduced conventional forces, would be more likely to trigger the tripwire, or is he talking about Russia triggering the tripwire, or another country? So that's kind of a frightening theory in terms of game theory, especially when, as David rightly points out, he's not being very specific about things. But this is a very real theory that is being kicked around in military circles and in sort of strategic circles and so forth. And I'm sure there's quite a few academic papers on that very subject itself. But, look at the drills in Norway recently around the Arctic Circle. Mm. And so you have this kind of a lot of noise being made. It's a lot of rooster activity going on this side of the NATO Iron Curtain. And does Russia really take that seriously? I mean, we're doing drills with Prince Harry about Russia invading Norway. Mm-hmm. Russia's not going to invade Norway. It's not going to happen. It's never happened in history, as far as I know. I think maybe Germany did sort of an invasion in World War II, but not Russia. Mm. So there's just a lot of noise. So is the posturing, is the whole military posture for domestic consumption? Mm. Or is it really for internet? Is there a real strategic imperative in the post-Cold War, period? Mm. Is it really a strategic imperative? Or are we just going through the motions, Mike? Is this shadow play, post-World War II shadow play? When the whole international defense industry just become a commercial concern that just needs to keep going, it needs to keep promulgating itself. Where is the real threat? Where is the threat from the West?
That's a good question. Now, speaking of threats from the West, let's have a look at the conventional image, shall we say, of the First Sea Lord. This is Admiral Sir Philip Jones. And this image is from the Royal Naval website, so that's how they like to present him. Well, we have another image of the First Sea Lord, Admiral Sir Philip Jones, to show you. And he's got some of his friends with him, and here it is. And so for everybody watching, let's have a play a game of whose flag is it anyway? So there we go, David. We should perhaps put some labels on this, so just so that everybody knows. There is Sir Philip Jones there in the middle. And for those that have got the answer to whose flag is it anyway, we've got some EU flags over to the left here. But just so that everybody knows that this took place on British soil, if you could look closely at the image, at the picture at the back, the painting at the back, there we have Margaret Thatcher. So Margaret Thatcher, David, is very unlikely to appear in a painting on the back wall of a room in Brussels. She was not their favourite person, so I don't imagine that this image was in Brussels. Do we know where this image was taken?
I believe that it's at Royal Navy Trident Nuclear Headquarters, Northwood. So have you got any comments in your chat box at this stage? What are people saying? Have you got a reaction?
A traitor's in your face, perhaps? Does that...
We're at the strong end of the spectrum then, right. So this is really, I believe, for everybody watching now, a very, very potent image. Because whilst we had the huge public outcry, once it was promulgated, the three-para incident under EU command and control wearing EU insignia on their shoulders that went viral. People go, no, we don't want that, very much on the Maggie Thatcher. And I'm not saying that, I agreed with everything that Maggie did, and I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that were the same. But where this regard is, I'm in complete agreement with her. It's a very definite no, no, no to currency union, military union, and the loss of the veto. So I understand that picture is about the Falklands War prior with Admiral Lewin, Fieldhouse, and Leach.
That's a painting at the back.
That's a painting at the rear. So if there are any Royal Navy chaps out there and watching, will they please chip in on this? But what I fundamentally believe we've got here is a very, very strong image, probably stronger than the image that we pushed out about the three-para guys serving
because there's not a union flag to be seen there, David. There's not a union flag to be seen.
There's no union flag. Those are predominantly senior British serving officers of the Crown, which is where their oaths lay, stood next to EU flags. There's no union flag in sight. And we ought to be having a huge appeal to everyone here for a public outcry on this, because I believe this is fundamentally more important than what we saw in Sarajevo, because this is demonstrating to everyone exactly where we are with this. It's totally in your face. So can we all please sort of grab the screenshot when you're watching the news and get it pushed out there, and let's try and get the lid off this, because this is in real time. This is last week.
Yes.
So what
yes,
we've got...
Sorry, David, I was just going to say the key point here is that another week has gone by. We're going to have another statement in the House by Theresa May this afternoon. We're going to have another motion in the House this afternoon. We're going to have amendments to that motion this afternoon, and we're going to have debates up until the 29th of January. And at no point in any of those debates will EU military unification or Britain's involvement in EU military unification, either during or post-Brexit or in, you know, over the next 20 years, this is not part of that debate. It needs to be part of that debate, does it not?
Absolutely correct. It's being held separate, and yet it's fundamental. So we've got this faux Brexit really being conducted at the moment. It's a facade of leaving the EU without this being dealt with. So we've got some sort of constitutional Groundhog Day test going on in Parliament just to see if any of the members are actually awake at the moment and anybody's actually going to aware of this. Otherwise, if there's no resistance, it's just going to carry on.
Right.
So on earth, you can say that we're leaving the EU whilst you actually have, you know, this is, I understand last week, all those senior officers there. You've got two, you've got one former Commandant General of the Royal Marines and one serving Commandant General of the Royal Marines, Mr. Strickland, and Mr. McGowan sat next to the First Sea Lord there. And this is blatant. There needs to be an outcry with this, you know. Everybody got behind the three power thing, and I want everybody to get behind this and really push it as hard as they can, because otherwise, you know, we're just frankly, to use sort of East End language, we're all being mugged off.
Yes, right. Well, look, we need to move on with this, but I just wanted to highlight this because this is obviously yellow vests, an image from a yellow vest protest in France. And one of the key points that you've been making over the last couple of years, David, is that this isn't just about military union, it's also about civilian policing as well and unification of that. The question that I've been asked, a number of questions I've been asking about this, first of all, why is the press currently silent about the deaths and injuries that have happened as a result of these protests? The question is, who's actually behind the masks of the gendarmerie that are there? Is it an EU gendarmerie? Now, I understand that there's more evidence coming to the fore that it is an EU gendarmerie being deployed here and not just French police. But one thing that I wanted to highlight from French mainstream media is this little infographic which shows the injuries. So 84 cases of severe injury for the yellow vests. And out of those, 77 were as the result of headshots. Now, what are we talking about here? We're talking about so-called non-lethal weapons, plastic bullets, rubber bullets, battery rounds, batten rounds, whatever you want to call them. These are supposedly non-lethal, and yet we have at least one person in a coma as a result of severe brain injury because he was shot in the back of the head. 77 people have been shot in the head. Now, the rules of engagement in Northern Ireland when these things were being used in the 70s and the 80s was quite clear that they were not to be shot directly at an individual. If an individual was to be hit by these, it was to be as the result of a ricochet off the ground. So you were supposed to shoot them at the ground in the general direction of the crowd. This is ridiculous because we've got gendarmerie shooting people or aiming directly at people's heads here, Patrick.
And including 10 women, actually.
Yes.
Out of the total, 10 women have been...
Right. So if that is what's going on, and that is part of this whole unification process, just 30 seconds, David, please. That should be additional cause for concern, because if France has foreign gendarmerie going in to manage crowd control there, what happens? We know that we've got British military on standby, British police on standby, should there be any civil disturbance as a result of Brexit. But what happens then when we start seeing perhaps French or German or Dutch police are operating on British streets?
There's certainly very great potential for that. So thank you for bringing that up to everyone's attention. And a stark graph that you've got there. This, frankly, is the shape of things to come. You can see how they intend to proceed with this. So there's no reason at the moment to say that this wouldn't come into Britain, because obviously the close, I think Lord Attlee there said, close security relationship with the EU This is what it means. When they say security, it's everything. It's defense, military, police, security. It's the whole thing, all unified. So there's no reason that we're not going to see this type of approach being attempted to be used in Britain. And I'll close with this, that when I met with Lord Tebbit some time ago and we discussed these inner workings, he said to me in no uncertain terms, of course, David, you do realize they will attempt to use this internally as well as externally. And Lord Tebbit was completely correct, because that's exactly what they're doing now in France. So everybody needs to wake up. This is the shape of things to come unless it's stopped.
Have you any thoughts on this?
No, I think David's outlined that and yourself pretty well, Mike.
Okay, well, let's move on to Italy versus France. What's going on here?
Well, I'd love to say this is a football match, maybe an international friendly, but unfortunately not. The Italian leadership has locked horns with France. You know, this started a few months ago, or about a month ago, with the Yellow Vest protests, and the Italian leadership saying, Salvini commenting that he's basically warning the rich north, as it were, of Europe, that, you know, unrest is coming, there will be more Yellow Vest movements, and that France may not be able to contain this popular uprising. And so if you... The deputy prime minister here, this is the leader of the Five Star Movement, Luigi Di Maio, has basically made a statement that it's pretty amazing, Mike. He says, we'd be hypocrites if we just continue to talk about the effects without looking at the causes. If today we have people coming from Africa, it's because some European countries, like France, have never stopped colonizing Africa in their heads. This is kind of an amazing statement, Mike, because if you look at the media coverage with regards to the migrant crisis over the last sort of 5 years, it's really commenting, the outrage is always on, oh my gosh, we need to do something about this migrant crisis. There's never any actual talk. We talked about this in the past about the BBC, who have systematically whitewashed the dialogue about what is causing the migrant crisis. The biggest one, of course, is Libya. Mm-hmm. The war in Libya, opening up a corridor so that migrants can come from sub-Saharan Africa and besiege the southern countries of Europe, Mike. But what is he really talking about? Well, what Di Maio, the Deputy Prime Minister of Italy, is really commenting on here are the Francophone countries. And specifically, he's talking about the CFA franc. A lot of people don't realize that a number of these former French colonial possessions have basically money that's issued essentially and backed by the French treasury. They're called the CFA franc. And so this little graphic here with Emmanuel Macron, and apparently, you know, those who advocate for this, Mike, have said that it brings great stability to these former French colonial countries. So, but the question is, Mike, stability for whom? And if you look at what's really interesting, if you look at this currency, which is pegged to the euro, it provides a uniform framework for trade between the French Francophone countries and France. So what is that? Whose advantage is that? Well, this provides, it requires, they're almost, these countries have to export their raw materials, guess where, to France. And it creates a cheap dumping ground for French products in Africa. But the biggest thing about this, and what the Deputy Prime Minister of Italy pointed out, was this CFA franc finances French public debt. This is very similar to how the United States finances its budget deficit, its public debt, through the dollar as a world reserve currency. Mm. So they're able to game the international financial system and create dependency relationships with regards to the U.S. dollar. And so France is essentially doing this kind of like the United States, Mike, but on a smaller scale. But and as the Deputy PM of Italy also pointed out, if France did not have this dependency relationship between these African countries, France would not be in the top 10 economic powerhouses on the global rankings. It would be much lower. So he's really putting forth the case that this is one of the reasons why these African countries have been depressed in this dependency relationship. He is advocating for the EU to issue sanctions against France. So So whether that's going to actually happen or not, but he's calling for sanctioning of France, and he's blaming this because who's bearing the brunt of the of this latest wave of the migrant crisis, Mike? Italy is bearing the brunt. Mm. Greece as well is bearing the brunt, but especially Italy with regards to the sub-Saharan Africa, Spain as well. Mm-hmm. So you, again, we're seeing this division, the poor south of Europe, those hit by the 2008 financial crisis particularly hard, and also by the migrant crisis, and insulating the rich north. So the problems of the south are felt, while the problems of the north, they don't feel it in quite the same way, although they have serious issues with the migrant crisis, political upheavals in Germany, and France has this as well, mm. in other countries. But it's nothing like the frontline countries, Mike.
Mr. Di Maio was speaking on Italian television at the end of last week, and he was asked about the newest conflict between Italy and the EU. So he's not just in conflict with France, but the EU as well, and with EU institutions, particularly with regard to banks' non-performing loans. And he said to demand that non-performing loans should be fully reset within 2026 means to tell Italy, which is one third of all non-performing loans, close your banks. So he's complaining that the EU is basically saying that Italy has to deal with this problem. And he's saying basically that they're telling him that that Italy has to close the banks. So he said before intervening, we must do three things. First, a rule that separates speculative banks from commercial banks, from those banks that make loans to the real economy. I mean, between banks that gamble on the stock market and banks that use their deposits to lend to the real economy. It's called the Glass-Steagall Act. And we must do it as soon as possible. He said, I believe that Italy demonstrates that going back to good old practices of her fathers and grandfathers is not always a bad habit or a wrong thing. And in fact, many countries are going back into that direction. And then he went on to talk about the fact that they are setting up a public bank for investments, which is going to be separate from that banking system. And this is basically something that they promised in their coalition agreement. They want to support small and medium sized businesses in Italy. So absolutely coming out against the European banking system.
Wow, you know, Mike, he sounds a lot like an alternative media pundit, doesn't he? We've been calling out the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was Bill Clinton's last parting gift as President of the United States to Wall Street. This is why Goldman Sachs rewarded Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Clintons in general so handsomely, and why HSBC and other great financial institutions could be in this sort of this circle of power and influence so closely aligned with the Clinton political machine. So, Mike, he's calling for a Glass-Steagall for Europe, essentially.
Yep.
It's fantastic. And he's calling for a public bank. And this idea of a public bank or state-managed, certain state or public-managed parts of the economy, specifically with banking, these are things that Libya has instituted, Syria has instituted, and other countries who have found themselves under the cosh of the United States military, for instance. So interesting development, Mike.
Under the cosh of the United States military, which basically means the military arm of the global banking system.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, if we're talking about unrest in France and trouble with Italy, Greece, things aren't so good either. So what's been going on?
Well, if you haven't seen the news yesterday, and I don't know what the British press is saying, but this is CNN here, who have said tens of thousands of people out on the streets in Athens, Mike. And I have to tell you, I watched the international coverage of this last night, and it's not tens of thousands of people, Mike. We're talking about 500,000 people, hundreds of thousands. So they've downplayed this in the Western press. And what are they protesting here in Athens? They're protesting this deal that's been struck between Greece and the Republic of Macedonia for the name change of Macedonia. Of course, the Greek province originally named Macedonia. There's been the controversy ever since Macedonia, this new Republic of Macedonia, former Yugoslavia, state was made recognized in the early 90s as part of the breakup of Yugoslavia, instituted by NATO, by the U.S., led by Britain and the U.S., in fact. So this is one of the hangovers from the Yugoslavian War, Mike. So this is the birthright of Greece, in their opinion, Mike, that this is a name that is a Greek name and not a Slavic name. So there is a tribal aspect to this in terms of ethnic rivalries in Europe, but really it's historic. It would be the same, Mike, if it would be the same if I don't know how to describe this. How would it be in Europe if Scotland changed its name to England, or broke from the UK and changed its name to England? There might be some protest, I think.
Yes.
In London, maybe, or some other parts of the country.
But do you think the issue of Macedonia and the name is something which is absolutely critical to the people of Greece, or is this just a straw that has broken the camel's back? And you know, ultimately, Greece of any country in Europe has been suffering most since 2007, 2008. This is a continuation of a process that began then, isn't it?
It's been a process that's before that, actually, Mark, and you think you're getting down to the heart of the point. This is what this is all about. Greece has been a political football since the end of the Second World War. So the Warsaw Pact and all these various agreements that came to stabilize Europe or mm-hmm. supposedly in balance between Western Europe and the Iron Curtain. Greece has always been a pivotal piece on that chessboard. Mm-hmm. So they've been, in fact, Greece withdrew. It was one of the early NATO members and withdrew its troops from NATO. That was over the Turkish, the Turkish controversy. But this is about NATO. This is about Skopje. The capital of Macedonia, the government there, the NATO wanting to add another member state to NATO. This is, I think, and Greece opposes this, has opposed this for a long time. So it is much deeper than the name of Macedonia. I think this really has to do with NATO's eastward expansion, and many people in Greece would agree that NATO has betrayed an agreement between the United States and the Soviet Union that the former Warsaw Pact countries would not be, you know, they wouldn't encroach any further than Germany. And of course, NATO is all the way to the Russia's border and encircling it. And this would be one of the final pieces in that sort of daisy chain of NATO expansion eastward. So I think that's what it's about, Mike.
Right.
That's certainly a deep concern, I think. And I don't think Greece is particularly anti-Russian. Mm-hmm. Certainly you have the connection with the Orthodox Church. You have a lot of good historical links as well. And so there's no reason. Greece doesn't want to be that political football being kicked around between the battle between East and West anymore. And I think that's what's being expressed here.
David, did you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. That's some good analysis there, Pat. There's several aspects to this. Is that one, you're seeing the cradle of democracy there absolutely smashed, annihilated, and we're seeing this dreadful trouble in France. People often, so just so we sort of frame the context here overall, we're having this very perverse argument and propositions put to us currently in Britain again about the EU. And they're always waging this economic and trade and ridiculous argument that nothing like the reality. So my comeback line to these people is, well, what's the payoff? Well, if there's some, you're waging this kind of argument all the while, what's the payoff? Show me the payoff. And where you would probably think that they would say, oh, well, there'll be everybody will be richer. You know, we're going to get richer. Well, that's not happening. I can tell you precisely what the payoff is. You're looking at it. They're in Greece and they're in France. That's the payoff.
Chaos. Yes. Okay. Well, look, speaking of chaos, let's move on then, Patrick, to Syria. Well, Israel is once again attacking Damascus. Not much outcry from the rest of the world, it has to be said. But these images on screen at the moment have been released by the Israelis themselves. So four Syrian servicemen killed, six wounded was one report I saw. Israel says the attacks are targeting Iranian forces stationed in Syria and has warned Damascus not to retaliate, according to various reports. Why shouldn't they retaliate?
I think they're even backtracking a little bit now, expanding that definition, Mike, to Israeli Iranian interests. Israel claims it's attacking Iranian interest or Iranian-influenced facilities or something like this. So you can see they're sort of already watering down that definition, Mike, which is opening the door for more attacks in the future. This is kind of a disturbing pattern. Imagine if Russia had attacked and killed four Ukrainian soldiers, Mike, with missile strikes. Would there be international outcry, do you think?
I think there might. Now, the question I wanted to ask you was, is Israel's belligerence here and determination to continue attacking, does Trump's decision to withdraw from Syria, has that given them some reason to up their efforts?
It would definitely open the door for, say, less over the surface interference from the United States and what Israel's wanted to achieve strategically or militarily against Syria, Mike. But that's a lot of that is window dressing, and certainly everything that Israel is doing with Syria would have the tacit backing of the United States. Mm-hmm. They would be fully in the loop. The U.S. would be about what Israel's doing generally, I think. So this just opens the door a little bit for the facade of Israeli independence with regards to being able to pursue its strategic objectives on behalf of the United States, because Iran is also a sworn enemy of this administration in Washington as well.
Yes. Okay, well, look, we're in the last few minutes here, but we wanted to cover this story, the issue of the Press TV journalist who's been arrested in the United States, not charged, I believe. Patrick, am I right in saying that? So this is Marzeh Hashemi. She seems to have been arrested and detained on the basis of what?
Well, she's been arrested. She's not being charged. And what she's being arrested for, we'll go to the details in a minute, Mike, but just know that she's a very high-profile journalist. She's been with Press TV almost from the beginning of that network's foundation, I think in 2006, mm-hmm. 2005, 2006, 2007, the early days. So she is very high-profile, very well-known internationally in many different countries. She's an Iranian American citizen. She's born in America. She's originally from New Orleans, I believe. Mm-hmm. So that's what's important about this, and we'll give you some of the details in the subsequent slides. But this is what her son said. Just a little background. This is Hossein Hashemi. He said she's somebody who's harassed regularly every time she's going through airports. So much so, Mike, that she'll drive when she's in the United States, not to take any internal flights. Mm-hmm. For that reason, every time she travels using the air, she's pulled to the side each time. It's an hour-long, a two-hour interview, basically interrogated. And this is the crux of it. We go to the next slide. So what's important here is she's detained as a material witness. She was arrested by the FBI, Mike, not because she's guilty of anything, but they still hold the right with regards to the U.S. federal government will claim it has the right to detain a material witness if they can't be subpoenaed. So they've deemed that she's difficult to subpoena. Therefore, they've detained her. So she will then be testifying in front of a grand jury. And what is here's the question, Mike. What is the case? What are they cooking up here? Is this another show trial? Mm-hmm. Is this another Russiagate with regards to Iran? That's certainly what it looks like it's shaping up to be. So this is following a pattern set by Russiagate, which is to sort of demonize any English language, foreign English language networks from countries that are deemed to be axis of evil by the United States. So the FBI hasn't made a comment specifically on, you know, what this case is about, basically. But we do know from her family that she's in a prison. She's been deprived of, you know, I think there's some reports they've taken her hijab off. Mm-hmm. So in some cases, that's what I've read as well. She was in the U.S. coincidentally, Mike, which is the last point, filming a documentary about Black Lives Matter. And this is an interesting point. The last point, I think this is key, because if you look at some of the complaints and you look at some of the intelligence reports for where they're maligning RT in the United States, the big problem that they've had with this is that they're interfering in the United States, or trying to promote unrest in the U.S. or sow chaos. Basically, anybody reporting anything with regards to any serious social uprising or movement from a foreign language media outlet is going to be accused of interfering in the U.S., the political system, or sowing chaos, when in fact there's plenty of other outlets that report on these things, Mike. They just don't like it when foreign countries do, especially foreign countries that have been deemed as a rival or a strategic threat to U.S. interests. It kind of gives them an excuse to put the censorship yoke down. And I think that's what's happening here. I think this is U.S. Trying to regain, wrestle control of the narrative again. And they don't want people seeing this. Press TV's off the satellite networks, off cable in the U.S. It's been yanked off in the U.K. They pulled their license. It's off Utah satellite in Europe. So effectively, Press TV's already blacked out in the Western world for the most part. So,
Okay, well, look, we're going to end on a couple of items of fake news here. The first one is this that the Daily Mail pushed out. The headline is Defense Secretary Gavin Williams's toilet has paper featuring Vladimir Putin's face and a Russian insult. And, well, so, you know, what on earth can we say about this? It is a pretty despicable article, really. They say fears are the minister is putting his reputation as a statesman at risk. I think he's already done that. Moscow and Britain have been locked in a war of words after Novichok attack. Williamson has warned the East not to mess with Britain with the new RAF F-35 fleet. A source close to the defence secretary said the toilet paper was in the Ministry of Defence in his private chamber. Well, there you go. What can we say? I'll tell you what I think this is, Patrick. This is a placed story from the Boris camp. This is a nonsense story. It's fake news. It's not real. The image that they have of the toilet paper with Putin's face on it, as you can see, is clearly captioned there as Shutterstock. It is not an image from the inside of the Ministry of Defence. And so I think this is an effort to discredit Gavin Williamson from potentially becoming standing as a future leader of the Tory party. Now, I think Gavin Williamson has done plenty to discredit himself in recent months, so perhaps it wasn't necessary to do this, but that's what I think is going on here.
And the press like it because it looks like he's tough on Russia, so it feeds that appetite as well. So it goes down two sides of the mouth, basically.
Well, absolutely. David, just to end very, very briefly, what are your thoughts on this story?
Grotesque. Absolutely grotesque.
Yeah.
Grotesque, beneath contempt.
Yes, okay.
Just look at what's going through some of these people's brains. Well, if you want to call them that.
Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it at that.
Apparently, we're the problem. You know, we're the progenitors. Alternative media is the progenitors of fake news, not the mainstream media. They would never do that.
Well, look, we're gonna do a short extra time in a second for members only, but just take us through this final fake news article here.
Well, if you do join us for the extra time after the show for subscribers and members of UK Column and 21wire.tv, we'll talk a little bit about this, but this was a big story that broke. BuzzFeed pushed out a story that is just unbelievable. They claim that Trump had instructed his lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress and cover up some of his dealings with Russia, apparently building a Trump Tower in Moscow or something to that effect. And apparently this was so bad that even the office of Robert Mueller, who usually let these things slide because it supports their narrative, was forced to deny what is apparently a fabrication by BuzzFeed. And of course, what did BuzzFeed do? Well, of course, they doubled down on the claims made by their secret inside sources within the Mueller investigation. What's amazing is the Washington Post ran with this. CNN, of course, ran with it. They all ran with it, and no one hesitated at all. So, of course, the verdict is fake news. So this is another mainstream outlet. BuzzFeed is absolutely mainstream, Mike. It's mainstream media behind BuzzFeed. They've created a fake farm system like Vice News, for instance, for the mainstream people to kind of report on. So that's what's going on here. The Russiagate narrative, Mike, is collapsing. it's disintegrating, as we predicted. Mm. Eventually, it would happen. But now they're really running for the hills. It's amazing. We'll talk more about that on the extra time after the show.
Okay. Well, we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much to David Ellis for joining us today. Thank you, Patrick. And we'll see you again next Monday, I hope. And we will be back as usual on Wednesday. We hope to see you then. Bye-bye.